What? I don't have a gavel.
Let's find the gavel.
The gavel's over here. There we go.
All right.
The House Committee on Revenue for April 27, 2015 will come to order. I see that those are who are interested in House Bill 2643 are here and ready to work, so we'll open House Bill for public hearing, House Bill 2643. Is that Kyle? Is that you?
Yeah, okay.
And the representative from Springfield ought to move to the witness chair. I note that the Oregonian incorrectly said that I was the representative from Springfield today, and I wanted to make certain that, that we at least were clear on that.
Yeah. He didn't want to claim you.
Kyle?
Hey, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2643, the engrossed version, it would authorize the designation of Enterprise Zone, Electronic Commerce Zone, Electronic Commerce City, and Reservation Enterprise Zone by zone sponsor or sponsors. The zone sponsor may be a city, a county, port, or a tribal government. Designation of Enterprise Zone and boundary change of zone is subject to determination by Oregon Business Development Department, which would certify that certain statutory requirements are met. Requires the submission of documentation to OBDD before designation, addition, or change of a zone, and requires consultation with the department. It eliminates the numerical limit on the number of enterprise zones that may be designated at any one time, and lowers the minimum cost requirement for qualified property used in electronic commerce zone outside of a zone for electronic commerce, and it would take effect on the 91st day following adjournment sine die.
Great. Representative.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is John Lively. I am the representative from Springfield, though Representative Barnhart does represent all around Springfield, but not in the mostly not in the city limits, though a few cases there are. I appreciate this opportunity to provide some input on my bill on enterprise zones. As most people know, I've spent most of my career working in economic development in local communities and feel pretty strong about what works and doesn't work. And enterprise zones is one of those things that over the years has worked fairly well for communities. The key thing about enterprise zones, though, one, is timing. Historically, the state has had a numerical limit, which has changed a couple times, and Art Bishier from the department can certainly talk about that, has changed a couple times about as to the number of enterprise zones that can be in effect at any given point. Having come from local government first and then coming into state, I have some strong feelings about local governments and the role they should play. So my intent on this bill was just simply to allow local elected officials, who ultimately are the decision makers and are the ones most accountable to their voters on property taxes, to make a decision about an enterprise zone versus that the decision would be made simply because we were at the time of the cycle, there was no zones available. So everything else would remain the same as far as the requirements. Any local community where they chose that they needed to apply for an enterprise zone could do that. They'd still have to meet all the requirements that are set down forth in the ORS is currently Business Oregon, so we're not suggesting that we change those. But the key here would be that the local, in this case, city councils or county, could make a decision to do that. Why that's important is this. In most cases, in most smaller communities especially, when you might get the opportunity for that large investment or that key investment to your community, there's no way to predict. You might spend, I can tell you, I worked on projects 5, 6, and 7 years before the project came to the point that I might do it. And if at that point there's no enterprise zones available, and that enterprise zone or that tax abatement for property taxes could be a critical part of the solution, then the community is just stuck. They can't do anything about it. An example right now is Oak Ridge, and Art can probably speak to this, but Oak Ridge had an enterprise zone for years, never used it, never had an applications in that. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why Oak Ridge has struggled, but they're back to the point now that they might have an opportunity, but they don't have an enterprise zone because that zone has expired, and I'm not sure in the cycle if there would be one. But that's an example of a small community that has worked for years to try to do economic development. An enterprise zone would be important, but if the number, if there isn't one available at this point, then they wouldn't have access to that. So that's simply what I tried to do in this bill.
Very good. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart, members, distinguished members of the House Revenue Committee. My name is Arthur Fish with the Oregon Business Development Department, otherwise known as Business Oregon, and it's a pleasure to be here and speak in the utmost neutrality to this bill, but we've been very happy to assist the good representative from the city of Springfield. And it was a pleasure working with him in the prior committee and just, you know, going through and making sure everything was really cleaned up, you know, make sure, you know, that our, you know, the chances of a major fiscal impact or, well, you know, significant one was minimized and just, you know, have everything on a very consistent and clean basis for doing things a little differently here. I would just, I guess, note for the record that presently, we have received 5 applications from communities, all rural, including Oak Ridge, West Fir, and a few others about the state. And, you know, we've run out of zones that have resulted from sort of additional increases by the legislature, the last one being 2012. So right now we're recycling enterprise zones, and we only have 4 to recycle. So we're at that juncture again where we might, well, we haven't been there in a long, long time in my memory, but that we will have to sort of comparatively assess the applicants and so forth. Otherwise, I'm just here to answer any questions you may have, maybe walk through the major policy points in the bill and that sort of stuff.
Very good. Representative Davis?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you both for your testimony. And I think this is a question, Art, for you regarding under this bill, what procedures that are currently at the state level would be transferred down to the city level? So walk us through what an application would be like if this bill were passed into law. Who would do what?
I'm not sure. Well, I think the locals would do a lot of the same things they need to do now. They wouldn't be subject to an application round and those sorts of things, which are prescribed by the statutes. There wouldn't be a cap on the overall number. So it could be a sort of whenever you want to have an enterprise zone. And again, when I work with communities, the main challenge for them, I think, and sometimes to their great surprise, is the local politics of an enterprise zone. It's a very serious decision that most communities, for some it's a pretty obvious idea for them, but you know, it is a very serious matter of deliberation among the city councils and county commissions and port boards and so forth. And they would in effect under this bill actually designate the enterprise zone. And you know, our director who succeeded from the governor many years ago does that now. However, they would still need to adopt resolutions, essentially designating, provide maps and economic data as far as the hardship criteria, engage in consultations with local taxing districts, and essentially all they have to do now, you know, basically, though, there wouldn't be the overhang of having to maybe, you know, deal with a bunch of criteria about why they might use it best compared to competition. Which is what we're facing for the first time in a while.
Follow up?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So the local government puts their packet together, for mm-hmm. lack of a better word, passes resolutions. It still gets sent to you or Biz Oregon. And then what analysis takes place then?
Well, we would do really, that is Chair Barnhart, Representative Davis, members of the committee, we would do essentially what we do anyway, as far as mandatory requirements go, and basically just check to see that there is an economic hardship measure, you know, duly adopted resolutions, maps, and you know, a boundary description, and those sorts of things. That, well, that's about it. That really are necessary just to have a functional and statutorily permissible enterprise zone.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And I'm glad we cleared up the issue of which districts you and I represent.
I am, too.
Thank you. We have 3 others who asked to testify on this bill, Marcia Kelly, Doug Riggs, and Jody Weiser. So if they would come forward, and we'll let Doug go first. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill today? All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for record, Doug Riggs on behalf of the Central Oregon Cities Organization. In OLIS, or on OLIS, you have a letter from the City of Redmond talking about enterprise zones. I'd also point you to the Business Oregon website, which I'll refer to in a moment. But I wanted to just make a few quick comments. Central Oregon went through the depths of the economic recession in the last 10 years, and I will say that from a Central Oregon perspective, about the only thing that kept the lights on in Central Oregon was the Enterprise Zone proposals, projects. We had, at one point, unemployment in Deschutes County upwards of 10 and 12%, in Jefferson County approaching 20%, and in Crook County approaching 30%. So those are numbers that mean that almost half the workforce is unemployed if you factor in functional unemployment. And the only saving grace, as I said, was the ability over the last 10 years to use an enterprise zone to attract business to Central Oregon. The enterprise zone attracts high-paid jobs. If you look at the Business Oregon website, it has to be at least 150% or more of the county average wages. It cannot displace other jobs elsewhere in the county or the state. And there's some fairly strict criteria that have to go into it in response to Representative Davis's question. So we don't view this as being an open door to every location being in an enterprise zone. We view this as a targeted tool that's helpful in certain cases. It doesn't work for all business. It doesn't work for all communities. But in certain circumstances, this is invaluable as far as being able to create jobs. Jobs create economic development. Economic development creates tax revenues, and tax revenues, of course, are good for all of us in Oregon. So if you have any questions about the specific program, Business Oregon actually has a really good homepage on enterprise zones. It has an awful lot of detail. It's at oregonforbiz.com, and you can look at the tax incentives and enterprise zone eligibility criteria. But very helpful, and I encourage you to take a look at it at some point. But just in summary, strongly supportive of this bill. This has been an invaluable tool, and we hope that it's available for many years to come.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sorry. For the record, Jody Weiser for Tax Fairness Oregon. So we've recently learned a good deal about enterprise zones, largely because of a March article in the Oregonian. Do they have theirs? That I've given you a copy of. And there are, and from information that's now available on the Transparency website. So if you look at the map in this article, you'll see two areas that are darkly colored. The dark portion of the enterprise zone in the lower left-hand corner is an area of poverty, pretty abject poverty in Hillsborough. The slightly lighter colored areas are part of the same enterprise zone because we allow non-contiguous enterprise zones. And that land is mostly farmland that has been zoned industrial, is close to Highway 26, the Hillsborough Airport, and lots of utility infrastructure. And so the enterprise zone program was designed to help distressed areas, but it's hard to see how some of the best development land in the state could be considered distressed property. And it's considered distressed property because the lower left-hand corner was part of the same enterprise zone, and so the whole thing, the whole area, hundreds of acres, got to be called an enterprise zone. And as the article points out, Solar World, Genentech, Adobe, and Resurs have all located on this property. In fact, when the article was written, they had identified 15 new properties that came in since the enterprise zone, and only one of them was in the distressed area. The rest of them are taking advantage of the fact that there was either large building available or large empty land. A couple weekends ago, I came across an area I had noticed was ready for development when I was out biking, and suddenly there's a massive, massive building that had been built. I'd read that Resurs, which is headquartered in Oregon but has plants all over the United States, was moving their facilities because they needed larger facilities. Well, these are massive facilities. They wouldn't have fit on their old property, and there are very few places in around Portland where their workforce is that would have been available with such a large, flat piece of property to do what they did on it. They didn't need a tax break to go there. They needed the land. They needed the availability. And it was going to be in that sort of area or down by Wilsonville. And this is much closer to their current Beaverton facility. And so it's the logical place for them to build. And yet we've given them a tax break because we've created this large, large piece of farmland. And we're changing it into industrial land. And we're calling it a distressed area because of this neighborhood that is miles away. It's kind of like saying there's that empty block downtown Portland, and because there's a bunch of homeless people nearby, it's a distressed area, and we should give a property tax break to the builders who build there. Well, it's really hard to find that empty block in downtown Portland, and it doesn't need to have a tax abatement in order to get used. And so while we don't have any objections to the ideas behind this bill, this is one of the weaknesses of our current law that should be perhaps addressed, maybe using non-contiguous areas in as one enterprise zone should not be allowed, particularly if you're taking the limit off. There's no rationale for it. Okay. And the second area I took from the Transparency website, just the pages for the Hillsborough Enterprise Zone. And by looking at it, you can see that there are some facilities with very few jobs that are getting big tax abatements. These are primarily the new data centers. Well, data centers were not something we knew much about 5 years ago. And so our law does not reflect this reality. The worst example by far is the ASB Evergreen Data Center, the third one on the first page. There's one job and $775,000 a year of tax abatement for 5 years. We will never recover that money from the physicians in that business. And so it seems like another adjustment we might make to the program is, I mean, there's some of them that make some that make good sense.
And if you could wrap up, that would be helpful. I have two other topics to deal with today, okay. So we need to move along. If you have another point to make, please go ahead and do that.
So, I think this is that we should consider putting in the program a limit on how much tax abatement you could get per job. Maybe $3,000 per job, because that's the amount of income tax you might expect from a job. Something that makes it so that the state is not losing dramatic amounts of money, because, of course, both the state and the local community participate in the abatement because of the school funding formula. So I think the bill is an opportunity to look at those two issues that we should consider.
Thank you very much.
Marsha Kelly, Oregon Women's Rights Coalition, Chair Barnhart, and members of the committee. Just a reminder that whenever an entity, a county or a city, makes a decision to do an enterprise zone in conjunction with some limitations around the state, then other taxing districts are affected and not ask about the enterprise zone. This includes the school districts, and then therefore the point that Jody just made, whenever we give away property tax dollars, we start impacting the school distribution because of what the school districts do. So this is not only, it's only affecting their property taxes. This is affecting how we distribute money throughout the state for education, and I think it is very quickly destabilizing the idea that we were investing equally in students by the amount of money that we can invest.
Thank you.
Again, worrying about the numbers of jobs created for the amount of money that we're giving away in taxes. One job is not a great deal for a large amount of taxes. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Can I make a quick point?
Please.
The Record, Doug Riggs, on behalf of Central Oregon Cities. Just a couple quick points in response to a couple of the comments that have been made. We're not creating an enterprise zone for a distressed area. We're creating an enterprise zone for distressed people. distressed people may or may not live in that particular enterprise zone. In fact, in Central Oregon, no one lives in the enterprise zone because it's not zoned for housing. But lots of people live within 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 miles who are distressed and unemployed. The point of an enterprise zone is to keep people working or to get people working who weren't working in the first place. So that's point number one. Otherwise, in Central Oregon, without the enterprise zones, there would be no job creation and no economic revenue whatsoever. So it's not a zero-sum game. Second point I'd make is that I know in Central Oregon, because I've been involved in Central Oregon issues for 20 years now, when we create economic development and enterprise zones in Central Oregon, the school district folks and the people, same people who support K through 12, are at the table. And I know of no instances in Redmond, as a good example, where the school board came in and said, do not do the enterprise zone, because they view it as a win-win. So I think that it's incumbent on the communities to coordinate with education advocates in schools. If that's something that needs to be added to the bill, saying please talk to your K through 12 folks, I think that would be fine, because I think responsible city council members will do exactly that. If they are on the wrong side of education, they will be voted out in the next election. So, again, the most important point is the point of this enterprise zone program is for distressed people. So we have less distressed people, more people jobs, more people employment. The area is not necessarily as important as the distressed folks. So a couple
thank
quick
you very
points.
Much. Questions? Representative Davis, please.
Thank you, Chair. And I just have a question for staff, I think, or Art might be able to come explain it. I think I get the first three changes in the bill, but there's also an expansion of the e-commerce zone personal property tax treatment in this bill that I am still not grasping. Kyle, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, Representative Davis. I believe I noted that it's on page 17, lines 44 and 45, and it's just a change related to the 50,000 or more in the case of. So it seems a slight change, but it's one that I flagged for to look into a little bit further as well.
Okay, if you could do that, it'd be great. Thank you.
Yeah, complex bill. Other questions? Thank you so much. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2643. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2072 and House Bill 2898. Chris.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. These two bills deal with the film and video tax credit. In OLIS, there's just a one-pager summary of the policy points contained in the bills. House Bill 2072 increases the program tax credit cap from $10 million to $20 million a year. It changes how the funds are distributed. It defines a local media production project, and it removes the dollar cap on the reimbursement to local filmmakers and local media production service companies. It also creates a task force on the Oregon film and media production and is effective for fiscal year, beginning with fiscal year 2015-16. And 2898 modifies the cap that I just mentioned from $1 million to $2 million. That's the cap for the reimbursement to local filmmakers or local media production services companies. And 2898 moves the sunset date out to January 1, 2024, whereas House Bill 2072 does not change the sunset date.
Very good. Thank you very much. Representative Evans, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. I'm going to try to make my comments relatively brief, but it's about 2898A. Really, the bill does two things, but before I do that, I'm going to explain who I am. I'm Representative Paul Evans, representing House District 20, Monmouth Independence, West Salem and South Salem. And for the record, we like to call ourselves a district waiting for a grim episode to be filmed. So I will make that not-so-subtle hint.
You have a good audience for that particular comment.
Yes. Hopefully, they will listen about Western Oregon University being a prime place for that show. Anyway, House District 2898 really does two things. One is, as was explained, it ups the limit from $1 million to $2 million per project, but really more importantly, it extends the sunset. And I'm not a video film person, although I will admit that I like to watch them. However, in talking with industry, the sense of certainty provided by an extended sunset could really make the difference in terms of some of the projects that we might lose by not having a sense of certainty. So, for example, imagine a world where Undaunted Courage was actually filmed in Oregon as opposed to Georgia, which was an unfortunate circumstance because we were not able to compete as well as, I guess, Georgia could with a story about Oregon. I think that anything we can do in terms of helping the film and video enterprise expand is something remarkable, because in my simple approach, my simple math, every dollar spent on tourism produces a dollar of all types of benefit. Every dollar spent on film and video actually spends a dollar on tourism as well as a dollar on labor and services. The more that people see Oregon through film, video, and every other type of media, the more people want to come and spend, which I highly recommend. This bill hopefully will also encourage projects to get outside the Portland area and enjoy the areas throughout the state, small communities, large communities, and hopefully move our economy forward. So that's really the point of the bill. If I try to answer any questions you might have, there's people behind me that are much smarter on the technical aspects, but I think it's a smart investment of our scarce resources.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Evans? Thank you. Appreciate your being able to get here this afternoon. Appreciate
it. Yes, sir. Thank you for the opportunity.
I have been noted that there's a number of panels to come forward, so I'm going to call them in order. Tim Williams and Lana, is it Vinker?
Vinker.
Oh, there's an N. Okay. Good afternoon. State your name for the record and then give your testimony.
Let me go first.
Please.
Thank you, Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Tim Williams. I'm the executive director of Oregon Film, and I'm here to give you a general overview of the film, TV, and media economy here in Oregon and the film production tax incentives, which are addressed in both HB 2072 and HB 2898. Oregon Film oversees and administers the Oregon Production Investment Fund, or OPIF, and its affiliated program called the Indigenous Oregon Production Investment Fund, or IOPIF, as well as the Greenlight Oregon program. Together, these programs refund up to 20% of goods and services being spent in the state and 16.2% of verified wages for cast and crew working in the state. Over the past several years, thanks to this legislature's implementation of OPIF, we've already seen a steady growth in Oregon's film and video industry. The number of jobs, the amount of annual wages, the number of companies based here in the state have all seen sizable increases over the last 5 years. More specifically, Oregon's film and TV industry grew by 69% from September 2009 to September 2014. Nearly 1,000 jobs were added over the course of that same five-year period. Annual average wage for the industry was over $43,000 in 2013. And in the third quarter of last year, at least 351 companies in the state engaged in motion picture and video work. For the fiscal year 2014-2015, OPIF is tracking at least 24 projects made up of everything from feature films to interactive game development. It is important to note that these programs do not rebate any funds to project producers or production companies until all in-state spending has occurred and has been verified. Generally speaking, this spending exceeds the rebate by 10-to-15-to-1 ratio, and the turnaround time for these projects can generally be measured in months as opposed to years. The steady growth of in-state spend versus incentive payout continues on a year-by-year basis, from just over $35 million of verified in-state spend in 2009 to more than $135 million just for the OPIF program being tracked for this current fiscal year. This does not include the millions of dollars in commercial advertising budgets being spent here in the state by numerous creative agencies on statewide shoots. At least two Super Bowl commercials this year were shot in Oregon or by Oregon-based companies. This program is currently capped at $10 million per year, and last year that cap was hit within a few weeks of the program's resetting. This year, because of the repeat business and growth of the multi-year TV series that are based here in the state, the OPIF program will be oversubscribed even before it begins to reset in July. This means many projects, both from local producers and production companies, and from projects originating outside of the state, are being turned away or taken to other states with more robust and long-standing incentive programs. By way of an example, the Fox TV series, which recently aired called Backstrom, is set in Portland, but it is shot in Vancouver, BC. In addition, the HBO miniseries about Lewis and Clark, based on the book Undaunted Courage, as Representative Evans mentioned, is currently prepping and shooting in Atlanta and Calgary. And lastly, director Kelly Reichardt, who has shot four of her previous films here in places like Hood River, Medford, and Burns, just completed shooting her current project, which is set in eastern Oregon, in Montana. This is in addition to many homegrown projects which have inquired from places like Newburgh and LeGrand. This is an interconnected economy. which consistently reaches outside of its boundaries. And many people here today will attest to that. For every production that is developed and financed from sources inside or outside of the state, many local companies gain work and grow their experience and workforce and attract more into the state. Each project has a resonating factor which touches many parts of the state's economy. A great example of this project resonation can be seen through the lens of the feature film Wild. The international release and awards campaign for Wild created a sizable free marketing portfolio for the state. Partnering with Travel Oregon, this worldwide effort on behalf of Oregon's direct connection to Wild resulted in countless articles being written with a combined total circulation of nearing, if not exceeding, 100 million people. The Pacific Crest Trail reported a 300% upturn in visitors to its site upon the release of the film, and they expect this spring to be the busiest by far, both for day hikers and through hikers. All of this is due in no small part to the tireless work of Travel Oregon, in particular, to track and attend in person most of the rollout of the key international markets. This project continues to directly benefit the $9 billion tourism industry here in the state, not to mention Oregon's flagship outdoor athletic industry. Wild also brought direct impact to individuals and vendors throughout the state. More than 250 local vendors were engaged on some level in 23 Senate districts and 37 House districts, having an impact on two-thirds of the legislative map. In addition, it employed more than 200 people, including cast and crew, and spent more than $600,000 in hotel rooms and travel costs alone. The beauty of our state is abundantly cleared in this award-winning wide-release feature film, and it will undoubtedly lead to people coming here to hike the Pacific Crest Trail and visit many of the state's iconic locations featured in the film: Crater Lake, Mount Hood, Ashland, and the Badlands outside of Bend. Another specific example of Wild's direct interconnection with Oregon's economy comes in the form of Danner Boots. This Oregon-based company was approached prior to filming to create a custom boot for the film, replicating the iconic boot on the cover of the book upon which the film was based. The Portland-based factory was able to respond quickly, delivering several dozen pairs to the crew and shooting throughout Oregon. The boot, the Mountain Light Cascade, was then offered in a period-specific box made for the film, along with a patch calling out the Pacific Crest Trail mile marker from Mount Hood. During the fall and winter of 2014, the Mountain Light Cascade became one of Danner's best-selling styles for women, helping grow an emerging category for the brand. And lastly, it is important to note the attention and growth being garnered by the game development companies of Oregon. Since game development was made part of the IOPIF program in 2013, several of the state's local companies have used it as a tool to grow their workforce and develop their own projects. Oregon has recently been identified as being in the top 10 for game development across all U.S. states, with a significant industry cluster located in Eugene. The media industry is growing in Oregon. This business is a word-of-mouth business, and thanks to the success of these projects and the growth of our local creative workforce, the interest and demand for more production in Oregon is at an all-time high. Oregon is a destination state where creative people want to work. My office fields at least 3 inquiries a month about ready-to-go projects, all looking for available funds in OPIF. But the capacity and longevity of the program is not large enough or long enough to accommodate much of this additional work. I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have, and thank you, Chairman Barnhart, for letting me testify.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, my name is Lana Vinker. I am a casting director based in Portland, Oregon, and the president of Cast Iron Studios, a local film and television casting company established in 1999. I'm testifying today in support of HB 2072 and HB 2898. And in order to share with you what happens to real working people when the Oregon Production Incentive Fund is expanded. During the recession, my mom and her husband of 23 years both lost their jobs on the same day. After a few years of economic free fall, their financial situation took its toll on their already rocky marriage. And one day in October 2013, my mom showed up on my doorstep with all of her suitcases. And having worked in this industry for more than 20 years, I quickly realized this could be the premise of a new TV series, a comedy. My mom is known in my family as a cross between Mother Teresa and Lucille Ball. In fact, in one point when I was out of town on a business trip, she managed to get a hold of an industrial-sized caulking gun and, with the best intentions, caulked the grout on all of my bathroom tiles, creating a floor-to-ceiling mess that has left its scars to this day. But all jokes aside, the only reason I was able to support her for a year and get her back on her feet was the expansion of OPIF that brought us Wild and the Librarians in addition to Grimm, which we were already casting. In September 2014, off the heels of our busiest summer on record, I was even able to cover the down payment and closing costs on her new home, thank goodness, and now she's thriving for the first time in years. Last year, our company had set a goal to get revenue back to pre-recession levels.
I note that you're reading material that we already have in our record. It would be really useful if you could summarize the things, your main points. And then I'll ask the committee members to actually read your presentation.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Last year we had our busiest year on record, and it was fully due to the expansion of OPIF. And we estimate that if we get an increase again this year, we'll be bringing on another full-time employee, and we'll be buying even more equipment, hiring more actors, and probably giving people a few raises as well. So that's the long and short of it.
Long and short of it. Thank you. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you both very much for your testimony. I'm wondering where this program stands in relationship to the other states that have programs. I know many dozens of other states do. So both in terms of the aggregate size that we offer and then also the sort of generosity of the incentives, where do we stand?
Representative Davis, Chair Barnhart, there are approximately 40 states that offer film and production tax incentive programs. All of them are completely different. Some of them are tax credits. Some of them are rebates. Some of them are cash. Some of them are 30%. Some of them are 10%. I would say in aggregate, when you put all of that stuff together, we're probably in the bottom third of those states and those provinces. We're definitely much less than Canada. Where we have the advantage is, as I hinted at, is people actually want to be here. I find that we don't actually have to market shooting in the state because people would like to shoot in the state. However, every state that has every project looking to shoot in a state is always looking at the bottom line, and they will go to a state that has a better program. What our incentive does is it actually gets them here to have the conversation. Our incentive is also a rebate in cash, which has an advantage to many other programs where you have to sell a credit on to a third-party vendor, sometimes at a great discount. We don't do that. Mm-hmm. And so that gives us the advantage to get some really quality projects that want to be shooting in Oregon. One of the two of the bigger programs in the United States are Georgia and Louisiana, who both have 30 to 35% rebate on all state, on all in-state spending. And what happens there is they get a lot of production that goes there, which is very beneficial to many, many people working in the industry. But what I find with Oregon is we get the projects that actually want to be here, that take advantage of what we have, that sell a state that people want to go to, which then plays into all these other aspects of having media out there, like tourism and outdoor life and all that stuff that plays into Oregon as a state.
Paula?
Yeah, please.
And I realize you weren't here when we first instituted this, but perhaps someone on the committee can enlighten us how the heck we ended up at 16.2% credit rebate for wages versus the 20 for all other costs.
Representative Davis.
What was the magic that
Representative Davis and Chairman Barnhart? It's a combination of two programs. So the okay. OPIF program rebates 10% of labor, and the Greenlight program rebates 6.2%. So they're two separate programs that combine to get us to the 16.2.
Thank you. That's the magic.
And of course, that did answer your detailed question, right?
Perfectly.
Right. other questions? One of the issues that concerns me is an issue that we've been working on for a long time, and that is how we actually generate this rebate. Currently, as I recall, the rebate's generated through an auction of tax credits. Could you give us an idea of how that's going and what your sense of it is for what would happen if we were to significantly increase the dollar value of the tax credits available?
Chairman Barnhart, my sense of it is right now we have a very efficient auction program that happens every July. We are opening up this auction July 8th, I believe.
We are, the last round, we were at 99.5%. We had a very, very small leakage rate in terms of what it was, and we were also oversubscribed. So we do feel that there is a larger contingency of people out there to purchase the tax credits at auction. However, I'm not an economist, and I couldn't tell you how far up that goes, but we definitely feel there is a more of an audience to get it.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this deja vu moment. The question always is, for each dollar that we invest, what do we get back? And so that is the question.
Mm-hmm.
And so with all the broad information you've given us aside, what is that return? And when I've run these numbers before and looking at Massachusetts, all these other places that have done these analyses, it always appears that you get the state gets back about half to perhaps three quarters of the tax credit in tax dollars. So there's a space. We don't get all our money back. And it has to be filled with something else. And generally, I've always thought it was the promotion that the state gets. But we heard earlier today, in fact, the representative that appeared just before you said we don't want people to stay in Oregon and just visit. So perhaps you should show us in some of your work that the people you attract don't stay. They just visit. That would be apparently a more positive thing. But my question would be, what's filling that gap?
The induced and indirect spending that is going into the economy in general. And I know the reports you're talking about, and I think even our report in 2011, which was the last one we had about half as well on that front. And then the induced and the indirect monies that go to the crew comes into town and they have money to spend and they go out and they buy a coffee, or, you know, a company is hired like 52nd Street Hardware by Grimm and they do hundreds of thousands of dollars of business just in Grimm on their overall. So that money is being injected into their employees and their hiring, but not directly in tax dollars.
And of course, I asked that question of Chris a minute ago, and he's going to see what he can work up for us on that topic. But that is an important issue.
And a follow-up.
Please, event. Yeah, go ahead.
And it looks as though in our other tax credit programs, we declare victory and we move on, like wind power or other things. Are we there now with yours? Because it looks to me like Portland's got a reputation now built on the investment of the state. Can we say, well, enough is enough. Let's just save our money, spend it on something else, education, and let the success that we've now generated stand on its own.
Well, Vice Chair Bentz, Chairman Barnhart, the problem is all the other states that have them, and if we don't have them, we don't get the larger stuff that is coming in from out of state. And I think that is something I can attest to as being on the other side of that decision before I started working here, that you unfortunately chase the incentive dollars. When you're working on even the smallest project, you will go to a place that has a fluid system to give you some sort of financial, because there's so many of these in play at the moment. So while I think that Oregon is a destination where people want to be, and production is going very well here, and people want to work here, and I think we have some great series that shoot here on a multi-year basis, I also know the reality that if there was no incentive program, everything that is here now would go to where there is an incentive program, like Vancouver or Utah or California, if they have some form of, you know, financing behind them, which most of them do, except for the very smallest of programs.
And a follow-up.
Please, yeah.
Right, and as much as I'd like to believe that, when I saw the numbers, it looked to me as though our incentives were far less than the total amount of activity that's now going on. In other words, there's mm-hmm. other people showing up that aren't getting any of the incentives. But now, am I right there, or am I just making a bad assumption?
Vice Chair Bentz and Chairman Barnhart, no, you're not making a bad assumption. There is definitely an interconnection between our economy, between incentivized projects and non-incentivized projects, and they actually interconnect with each other in very, very many ways. But with Grimm and Portlandia and the librarians, I don't believe those top-line TV series that are here for many, many years would be here if it was not for the incentive program that we have. And those employees and talent trickle down into the other projects that are deciding to be here for other reasons.
Thank you.
Yep, thanks. Other questions? We have several other panels to hear from. Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your testimony. Don't be surprised if you get some additional questions as people think about this some more. And I'm going to butcher some names here. Jose Bihar, Michael Coker, and Tim Oakley, please.
Mm-hmm.
Gentlemen, state your name for the record and then give your testimony.
Sir, good afternoon, Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today on in favor of House Bill 2072 and 2898. My name is Jose Behar. I'm one of the producers of The Librarians. I work for Electric Entertainment. And I hope that I can shed a little bit of light to some of the Vice Chair's Representative Bent's questions. You do have my testimony, so I will just hit on the highlights so that I keep this briefly. Electric Entertainment started with leverage, and we brought leverage to the state of Oregon. To date, we've spent approximately $120 million from 2009 to 2014. We spent an average of $25 million per season. We did four seasons of Leverage, and we did one season of The Librarians. And now we're very grateful that we got picked up for a second season, and we start production in June, on June 3rd here in Oregon as well. Out of the $25 million that we spend per season, we probably get approximately about $3.5 million, and I will look back at my records and make sure that I give you the accurate amounts. Those $25 million stay in Oregon. We pay our crew members. We pay our vendors. Just for season two of The Librarians, we are going to be shooting in Oregon for 4 months. We're projecting about $27 million of Oregon spend, and that really translates into roughly 2,000 jobs across the board, and this includes crew members, this includes transportation crews, day players, extras, actors, and also we would hire over 300 or procure the services of over 300 businesses that are Oregon businesses, and they are located throughout the state. Besides just production and spending those dollars in production money, we are doing a few other things to try and contribute and grow this industry. We are maintaining state-of-the-art sound stages that in between seasons we make available to indigenous projects. So we have over 90,000 square foot facilities that when we're not shooting one of our shows, you know, Green Room was one of the movies that was shot there. We have some local commercials, and we allow producers to, Oregon producers to come and shoot their projects there. We just built a partnership with Clackamas Community College to be able to provide the opportunity to students to learn. It's an internship program, and we give them access to working professionals, and we allow them to meet their graduation requirements by shadowing people who are in the industry. And we're talking about production office, we're talking production on set, we are talking about post-production, VFX. For the first time in the last 5 years, we are opening our own VFX, visual effects, and post-production facilities in the state of Oregon. If OPIF is expanded, we will be able to not only provide services for librarians, but our subsequent projects. Now, one of the things that we have noticed, because we have our own visual effects company in Los Angeles, is that we budget X amount of visual effects shots, and we always go over, and there's always overflow. So one of the things that we're going to start doing is we're going to start with 6 visual effects artists that are going to be working exclusively on librarians. We're already anticipating that we are going to go over, and we're going to need more talent. Well, there are 2 fantastic visual effects companies in Oregon. That we've seen their work, and they're highly reputable in the industry. Hive is one of them, and I believe that we have somebody from Hive who's going to testify, and Refuge is another one. So we anticipate being able to use visual effects services. Now, I just got off the phone early this morning, and Dean Devlin, my boss, said, you know what, we are going to go ahead and we're going to create a game for the librarians. I hear the gaming industry in Oregon is thriving. I'm like, yeah, actually, as a matter of fact, I think I'm going to be testifying with some folks who actually do this for a living. So besides just producing our own shows, we are expanding. There's this cross-pollination with other businesses and within the industry and also outside of the industry. We spend a lot of money on construction supplies. We spend a lot of money on water and office supplies. Well, that's not directly related to production, but we still spend thousands and thousands of dollars on that. So that is where Tim was mentioning the indirect spending. There is quite a bit of money that goes into the economy. So far, we've infused $120 million into the Oregon economy. This year, we're planning on infusing another $25 to $27 million. And if you guys give us the opportunity to stay here in Oregon and not just bring the third season of Librarians, but other feature films and other shows, we will be spending more and investing more in the Oregon economy. So we hope that you give us that opportunity. So far, we've secured season two of Librarians, the funding for season two, and season three, as the program stands right now, there is no funding. So now we have to look at other places if that's not going to be a possibility here in Oregon.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Gentlemen.
Hello. Thank you, Chairman Barnhart and the rest of the committee for this opportunity to testify. I'm here to support bills HB 2072 and HB 2898. My name is Tim Oakley, and I own Oakley Design Worldwide, and Maverick Creative Props. Our shop is a specialty prop house for feature films, televisions, commercial work, music videos, and print campaigns. A lot of advertising agencies use this. My work can be seen in roughly 80 plus films, feature films, including The Dark Knight Rises, Terminator Salvation, Star Trek 1 and 2, The Reboot, Mystery Men, Skullduggery, and the upcoming feature film for summer, Jurassic World. My television work includes Grim Portlandia, Defying Gravity, Helix, Modern Men, and the TNT hit show The Librarians, to name a few. Most recently, I also created a large, very large one-off set piece for the Oprah Winfrey magazine for her June issue, and a futuristic set for the Intel's Alienware commercial spot, which is airing right now. Yes, I work on incentive and non-incentive projects. However, all these projects have one thing in common, and they were all created right here in the state of Oregon. When a project is brought to my attention, whether it is local, out of state, or overseas, one of the first things I will request in the initial meeting is I would like to keep the build process here in the state of Oregon. This way, all costs are spent locally, and all additional hires are local as well. In my 32 years in business, I have not had one production company say no. As my business tagline states, we are here to make you look good, and you being the client, the film client. If a client is happy, there is an excellent chance they will consider bringing their next project back to Oregon. Recently, along with fellow crew members, were informed that an independent film that we worked on last year would be seen at the Cannes Film Festival. Hundreds of film projects were submitted worldwide. Only 19 were selected for the director's fortnight. Green Room, starring Patrick Stewart, which was filmed at the Librarian Soundstage, was only one of three U.S. films selected for this category. This project had an 80% local crew and will showcase the state of Oregon not normally seen. The buzz on this film is already dynamic. You add this along with the recent 2014 Oscar-nominated film Wild, and this will draw others to bring more projects to the state of Oregon. This is why bills 2072 and 2898 are important. By increasing the incentive cap and the budget level, we have a realistic chance to bring possible award-winning projects to Oregon. Out-of-state production companies look for every penny to save when they are making their films here or television shows here. And if we are not competitive with other states, we are bound for failure. Being non-competitive is what I often hear when I am needed for an out-of-state project or location. I always find a way to ask one simple question. Have you ever considered the state of Oregon to film your next project? I often hear, we would love to, however, the incentive is not in our favor, which either means it's been tapped out or it's not large enough. This is why I urge you to consider passing these two bills, as this will be a step in the right direction to help bring in more outside film and or television projects to Oregon, which would add stronger economical business opportunities to the people of Oregon. And when business is good, so is the state. Once again, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, my name is Michael Kerner. I am the owner of Kerner Camera Systems in North Portland, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bills 2072 and 2098. First of all, thanks for the support in the past. The Oregon Production Investment Fund has been critical for the growth of my business. Since 2008, Kerner Camera Systems has close to tripled its revenues, and its capacity to serve our clients and our staff has grown from 3 employees in our Portland office to over 6 employees. Our rental inventory has increased from $2.1 million in value to $6.6 million. Kerner Camera has grown to become the largest camera rental house north of Los Angeles, all the way going to Canada and then east to Chicago. We're bigger than anybody in Minneapolis, Colorado, or San Francisco for that matter. Oregon has become a place where large creative projects become a reality, and we like to see our industry continue to grow. Not only do we invest in the infrastructure and equipment, but we are also investing in the community with discounted or free camera packages to worthy projects. And this year, in the fall of 2015, we're sponsoring 2 5-year scholarships at Portland State University, which are the first scholarships the PSU film program has received. My employees have platinum-level health insurance, and they purchase homes. Kerner Camera Systems supplies cameras for equipment for Oregon productions like Grimm, Wild, Portlandia, Green Room, The Librarians, as well as hundreds of commercials annually. This is a busy time of year. Grimm is wrapped, and now we're prepping for The Librarians, Portlandia, and other commercials. Your support for the Production Investment Fund is crucial so our state can recruit the next projects and maintain the work we already have. Please support these two bills, our state, our industry, and all of our company's staff, and the hundreds of freelance crew out there. Thank you for letting me testify today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all for being here. I want to ask a question of you that I ask of most people in this general world. And Mr. Behar, you mentioned video games as one example, I think, of the answer to the question I'm about to ask. When we're comparing ourselves against other places that productions might go, it always occurs to me to wonder what is our distinctive kind of advantage beyond simply the finances. So I wonder if you could point to things that we might look at as ways that we're building advantages that don't go away if and when the finances aren't there.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Reed, yes. There are so many benefits within the state of Oregon, and I don't mean to push buttons, but the fact that there is no sales tax, that's a huge advantage to productions. The talent, the pool of talent is incredible. Lana Wienker was here testifying earlier. The pool of actors that we are able to use is phenomenal. Normally, we would have to fly actors from Los Angeles for some of the minor roles, and we have been able to cast from local Oregon talent, which is fantastic. The crews, we have an incredible pool of labor that would be matched, and actually unmatched, because we were just shooting a big Warner Brothers movie in Louisiana. And Dean Devlin was directing, and every day he was always saying, I just want to be in Oregon. It's like the crew in Oregon would never do this. They would always, you know, have their, you know, cross their mm-hmm. T's and dot their I's. So the incredible amount of talent, the pool of talent. The realities, however, and I would like to share how is it that, at least for an independent production company like Electric Entertainment, how this works and how important the OPIF is. The way that we fund a television show is we get a license fee from the network, in this case TNT. Then we do foreign pre-sales, so we go to every market. And we, you know, based on this contract that we have with TNT, we say, hey, this is going to be a great show. These are the, this is the talent. These are the actors. And then we do pre-sales. And we go to a bank and we borrow against those pre-sale contracts. And that is a portion of the funding. So license fee, pre-sales, and then soft dollars, which is tax rebates, tax incentives. So we submit our paperwork, our application. Once it's been awarded, the Oregon Film Office, which they're phenomenal. They go through every line item in the budget, and then they give us a calculation as to how much we're going to be able to get in rebates. So then we go to the bank and we bank that document as well. So every single dollar, at least for an independent production company like ourselves, is accounted for, and it goes straight to the crew members, to materials to be bought, to post-production and visual effects. So there are many, many benefits in the state, but our financial reality as an independent production company, we would not be able to come back for season three if we didn't have access to those funds, because that's a bit, it's a big, big portion of you know, if the season's going to cost us $27 million and the rebate is $3.5 or $4 million, that's a big chunk of that. So then we have to go and chase those dollars, otherwise we aren't able to shoot the show, and then nobody works. So I hope that answers your question, Representative Reed.
Mr. Chair, maybe just a comment for me. I'm interested in the continued discussion of how we build the sort of things that are lasting beyond the financial investment we're making, and I think those are good examples of why it's a good investment.
If I may, Chair Barnhart, Representative Reed, another thing is the infrastructure that the current businesses are building. The fact that the demand has allowed Kerner cameras to have red cameras in the, you know, the latest and greatest and have the volume, well, that's also a consideration, because if Louisiana, or that's a bad example, but New Mexico gives us a great rebate, but then the equipment is out there, or there isn't enough cable in the state for the lighting, or we don't have enough actors, or we don't have enough extras, well, that's also a problem. So I think that we are doing together a great job in building the infrastructure so that down the road, then we rely less and less on these tax incentives, and then we create a real competitive market to be able to save on some of the other expenditures that take to shoot a whole television show.
Thank you, Mr.
Other questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. We appreciate your testimony. It's very, very useful.
Thank you.
Let's see. I'm at Rosemary, it looks like Colliver, and Al Kubias. And I have two more panels after this and then one more bill. So I think if we're reasonably efficient, we'll get through today.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Barnhart and members of the committee. I'm Rosemary Colliver, General Counsel of Leica Animation Studios, located in Hillsboro. I'm here to testify in support of House Bills 2072 and 2898. Representative Bentz, you were making the joke about people leaving Portland and shooting here and then leaving. Fortunately, with Leica, we will never leave, despite what happens with OPIF and whether it exists or how it's funded. Nonetheless, what makes Leica so special is that since 2009, we have produced and released three big-budget animated feature films, Coraline in 2009, Paranorman in 2012, The Box Trolls in 2014. And not to jinx anything, but we are, to date, the only animation studio that has been nominated for an Oscar for Best Animated Feature for every single film we've released. Our next film's in 2016, so let's see. But in order for us to do this, how do we do it? It takes amazing talent. Where do we get them? We get them wherever we can. And what Leica is intending to do is to grow its studio to twice its size. We break ground in 3 weeks. We're adding 105,000 square feet to our studio. Our goal is to release a film a year. In order for us to do that, we need to add approximately 170 employees at the height of production to get a film a year produced through the future expanded space of our studio. We currently have 430 employees to date in our current studio. In order for us to grow to this size and to access, tap, and find the talent that we need to continue to produce the films that we produce, the amazing quality of the films that we produce, we rely in part on OPIF. And OPIF's support of the production economy in this state has allowed us to access talent within the state rather than relocate them from outside the state or outside of the country, which we have done in the past. In the last several years, what we have found is that the Production Incentive Fund is essential to allowing us to do this. We have been able to source talent locally and talent that has been trained on the other production shooting in the state of Oregon. Between our last three films, also, we've had what we call roll-off periods until the start of the jobs for that task begin on the next production. For instance, for our rigging, set building, camera, visual effects, and lighting groups, we can have breaks of 3, 6, and 12 months between productions. While this period will shorten under the expanded studio, it will still exist. And the state's support for production in Oregon has allowed our talent to roll on to other productions in the state, thereby allowing these people to remain residents of the state and members of the community. In addition, by working on multiple production, whether it's in VFX at Hive or a commercial production over at House Special or on an electric entertainment project, this talent is provided with a deeper bench of experience, thereby benefiting all of us in the production community. And not only do we tap, access, and create a deep bench of talent in this community in the production field, quite recently, a large VFX platform called Shotgun, which is used by about 600 film studios, was sold to Autodesk. And what Autodesk did was they created a division, located it in their Lake Oswego offices, and brought in 3 ex-Leica production technology professionals to run the new Shotgun division of Autodesk out of Lake Oswego on a going-forward basis. So when in production, Leica spends over $40 million a year on talent alone. The annual salary of our production employees is just under $50,000 a year. On the Box Trolls production, in addition, our employees had 34 babies during the production. So we're creating a whole new community. we're birthing animators, we like to think. These employees have been very excited to make their homes here, to join the community here, and to raise their families here, and OPIF has made that possible. On, you know, some of the spends that we do, our films are usually between $60 and $70 million a year. In addition to that, and that's just our above-the-line costs, we spend another $50 to $60 million a year in promotions and advertising. We just entered into a new 3-film deal with Focus Features. We're distributed domestic by Focus and international by Universal. Under the deal that we have, based on the performance of our films, we are in a very special situation, and we are allowed to control where our production and advertising funds go. And we do spend over half of those funds here in Oregon. We have used Wieden Kennedy as our exclusive advertiser, working on spots for all of our films since Coraline, and intend to continue to do so. And in addition to that, we spend over $250,000 a year just at the local Apple store. So I can't imagine what we spend on our Nikon SLR cameras, but needless to say, thank you to OPIF for helping build the community here in Portland and in Oregon that allows Leica to continue to grow. And speaking of growing.
Yes. Vice Chair Benz, in absentia, Chairman Bernhardt and the rest of the members of the committee, thank you for letting us kind of come before you and talk to you guys as a community. My name is Alvaro Cubillas. I'm a partner at House Special. And we have a special kinship with Leica in that we spun off last July. So talking about growing a business. What you've heard here a lot is partners and a community that's basically, in a word, symbiotic. We're interrelated both with talent, and we're interrelated with a passion for creating film and video and content. I'm here to speak in support of House Bills 2072 and 2898. Want to thank you guys also for all the support you've given in the years past, as we were part of like a house and now in our own independent studio, and hope that you'll continue to do that support for us. It's been a blessing and an ability, and it's enabled us to be able to take creative risks and innovate on top of our already very aggressive commissioned and non-commissioned work. See, the primary ways that we've been benefited from, in our case, IOPIF and balanced out from OPIF, has been in our ability to create our short-form content that's been creating a lot of visibility externally out of the state for our state as well as for our studio as a whole, thereby allowing us to stay in the state of Oregon permanently. We have the great pleasure and joy of having and feeding a community here in Portland of 45 staff people currently right now. At any point in time, we have about 80 to 90 people in-house, of which are project hires, some of which are actually working at different times of the year at Leica, at different studios in town. And so what you hear from us is basically a community that's saying, at least from my perspective, is that the benefit that you've been providing both in the OPIF and the IOPIF has been extremely helpful for us in our ability to create great content that gets seen by millions and millions of people. For example, a recent short-form project that we created, Tale of Momentum and Inertia, has had over 5 million views in just a really short amount of time. It's been featured in several places of The Atlantic, USA Today, Nerdist, The Nerdist, which for me is a particularly important place to see, and has been highlighted as staff pick on Vimeo, which gets just tons of views from my kids. Appreciate it. Hey, Dad, here you go. Check this out. And they've seen a lot of those projects kind of come through. But that's materialized in very real ways for Oregon. It caught the view of an advertising agency in Minneapolis called Mullen, who then commissioned us to do work for a project for Indeed, which allowed us to then also hire a series of folks to have that commercial project created, and then again symbiotically kind of feeding ourselves back, all because of funds that we were able to get both from our commission projects and benefited from our IOPIF projects also. I'm happy to answer any questions if you guys have.
Thank you very much. Representative Benson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for being here, and thank you for your success. The kids loved those films, and I kind of liked them too. Through a series of unlikely events, one of my in-laws works for, or did work for, Lucas. And they quit and went out and opened their own group to teach animation online. And I was astounded at the numbers. It's amazing. But it leads to my question, which is, when you're doing this kind of work, it appeared to me much of it can be done not here, but elsewhere around the world, if you find a good animator in, let's say, China. So my question is, how do we make sure our tax credit is inuring to the benefit of this state
people
and
here,
not someone in Czechoslovakia? Not to pick on Czechoslovakia.
Well, Representative Benz, Chairman Barnhart, one thing that also differentiates Leica from other animation studios, and I would invite you to come out and see it firsthand, as some of you have, is that we do stop-motion animation. And so it actually does have to be done here, because we build every single blade of grass, set, puppet, sew every little costume, and it actually does have to be done in our studio. So we do some visual effects and CG work after we've done what we call principal animation, which takes about a year and a half to shoot, because an animator can basically, right now on our production, we're producing 3 seconds of film per animator a week, and we're trying to put together an 83-minute film. So we have 41 animators, 3 seconds a week. We've got a ways to go. So the VFX and CG groups actually work very closely with our animators on the stages and on the sets with the puppets, because it's You need to see it. The rigging and green screen.
My follow-up would be simply, that's great, but I'm just guessing that others, including yours, business, does some off-site work. And the question is, should this group be worried about that? And should we be doing something to make sure, know the thing's already designed in a way that we hope is specific to the state? But you could be of great help to us if you could say, and you should be doing this, to make sure those dollars actually end up being spent here in Oregon. And if it's already your understanding of the credit working in that fashion, then hooray, we just need to hear it from you.
Well, I do believe that that it works in that fashion. What we have been able to do is build a talent pool that we've been able to keep here in the state of Oregon. And like Al said, and like as well with others in the room, is we have shared our talent between productions so that during our roll-off period, we can bring them back on. So our talent pool stays within the state as far as our total spend. So that's our labor pool of, you know, $40 million a year that stays in the state. While we do send some of our work outside of the state, it's actually very little. And it would basically just be a portions of our promotions campaign that Focus ends up running just for talent purposes and warm bodies that they have down in Los Angeles.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think, Representative, that's a great question for Tim Williams, and we'll ask him that question. Other questions for this panel?
I have one thing to add to
Please, yes.
And this is to Representative Benz. We have the opportunity to work with talent internationally, and there's talent that does come around. We choose to keep our staff locally and work with our staff locally because the deep amount of interactivity between our directors, our clients, and our other leadership team inside the studio requires the kind of timely response that's very difficult to get, even with cutting-edge technologies that we have today available to us. We choose it because we enjoy the state and we like where we live, and we're going to continue to do that.
Thank you very much. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony today. I'm going to have trouble here, aren't I? It looks like Gretchen Miller at Lindsay Gupton and Nathaniel Applefield, please.
Chairman Barnhart and members of the committee, I am here to speak in support of HB 2072 and HB 2898. My name is Gretchen Miller, and I am a co-owner of Hive Effects. Hive is a visual effects and animation company based in Portland. In addition to clients such as Nike, we are one of the primary vendors doing creature morphs for Grimm. Having a show like Grimm come to Portland has created an incredible opportunity for Hive to grow our business. We started our company 7 years ago when little was happening in the film and TV industry in Oregon. We got by with smaller local jobs, as well as a steady stream of Nike work. Since Grimm came to us, we've doubled in size and revenue. We've hired local college graduates from all over Oregon with well-paying jobs, and we want to continue to do this by attracting more work in and out of Oregon. Because of these programs, we were just awarded a qualifying project with the National Geographic Channel in New York. These programs like IOPIF and OPIF are great tools for us because they help us establish a healthy balance of local non-incentivized work as well as out-of-state incentivized work like the National Geographic Channel. With that said, bills like this are critical to bringing more shows to Portland before Grimm wraps. That is why I'm here today as a business owner. I want to find more cornerstone projects like Grimm so we can continue to thrive beyond Grimm. Having incentive programs like this give us the necessary edge to do just that. I ask that you please support these bills.
Thank you very much.
Hello, Chairman Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Lindsay Gupton. I'm the president of Pipeworks in Eugene, Oregon, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2072 and 2898. We're an interactive game developer. In fact, we're one of the longest-standing game developers in the entire country. Just celebrate our 15th anniversary. very proud to be standing alive and strong for this long. Game developer is a lot like, we like to think of ourselves as like a little Pixar type of studios. We do everything that goes into a game, the design, the technology, the story, the art, the animation, audio, the testing, everything that goes inside the game. We're also a small business that's been very directly impacted by IOPIF and OPIF in three important ways. Number one, it's been instrumental in helping secure important projects by being very competitive. It's enabled significant job growth through our company, and it's enabled a fundamental shift in our business model. A little bit of history of video games and why they matter in this context. Oregon, and Eugene in particular, was actually one of the largest game development centers in the world in the 80s. In early 90s, kind of the early days. This was due to a company called Dynamics, which was spun out of the University of Oregon, and in its heyday had 300-plus employees, one of the largest in the country, if not the largest. At this point, the game industry is estimated to hit $115 billion in 2015. However, the Oregon game industry was largely left behind by the boom in game development, the early 2000s, where Seattle, the Bay Area, L.A., Texas, Canada, all grew very strongly while the Oregon community shrunk over that time. Many of the studios went out of business, were gobbled up by out-of-state companies. During the recession, Portland largely disappeared from the games market. And Eugene, ourselves, lost several studios. But if you fast forward till today, thanks to the rise of independent studios in particular, fueled by the IOPIF fund, we're seeing a remarkable resurgence of the game industry in Oregon and our company at large. Using ourselves as a case study, the fund was, again, instrumental in securing projects. I'll highlight four. The first game that was incentivized under the IOPIF program was Godzilla Smash 3 that we did with our partners, Warner Brothers, alongside the feature film. Big success story, over 5 million downloads, an almost perfect rating, and it's still being featured by Apple a year after it's released. Another one at a completely different angle was the World Series of Poker, the most state-of-the-art poker game as yet created. A third one in a completely different way, Strike Group Defender, done with the U.S. Navy and MIT, which is used currently deployed throughout the Navy to train our sailors to protect themselves at sea against anti-ship missile defense. It also won Serious Game of the Year last year, which is the highest honor given to games of this type. And most recently, just earlier this month, our first totally original game called Soccer Die. These are just a small sampling of the products we've done, but these alone have brought over $5 million to the local economy, all from out-of-state clients. On the jobs front, we're a small company, not nearly the size of Leica, but we had 38 employees prior to the start of IOPIF. Since then, we've added 23 jobs in about 18 months. I'm forecasting an additional 17 jobs by the end of the year. So the jobs we've already added have added $1.49 million to our payroll and the Eugene economy. I'm looking at all total adding $2.85 million through the end of this year and about $800,000 in working with outside contractors. One thing that's very important to note is that these are all full-time jobs with excellent benefits. Almost everyone that comes to our studio stays for years and years and years. They're not temporary jobs that go away when the games go away. These are engineers, artists, designers, animators, audio folks, producers, finance, testers, admin, IT. A large number started as interns or recent graduates, particularly from UO and OSU. We love to bring people into the studio right out of college, doing a job that is something that they're deeply passionate about and have that turn into a remarkable career. The third thing, which has been profound for us, is that thanks to reinvesting into technology and original IP, we've had a 180-degree shift in our company's business model from doing primarily work-for-hire contract-type projects to internally funded original IP development. In fact, we have four of these games in production as we speak, and this has actually enabled us to spin off from our foreign parent company to be an independent studio focusing on our own work and a part of an international group that has publishing and distribution for a much broader reach and audience than we ever had before. This would have been extremely hard to do without the Incentives Fund. It was the spark that we needed for our company and for the resurgence of the broader games market in the state. Thank you again for your consideration.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Nathaniel Applefield. I'm the interim executive director for the Oregon Media Production Association. I'm here today to support House Bills 2072 and 2898. OMPA represents hundreds of Oregon's media production professionals, from cast to crew, from producers to vendors. I first want to thank you for supporting our growing industry through the Oregon Production Investment Fund. This program is not just attracting productions from out of state, it's building a sustainable industry here for Oregon. While we know that the Oregon legislature faces difficult decisions this session, there are a few things about our program that I'd like to highlight. Last year alone, $10 million in investment from the state of Oregon created $135 million in economic activity. I don't think it takes an economist to recognize that that is a huge return on investment for the state. While we are in competition with other states to recruit work, we rank in the bottom third as far as what we offer. We're still winning this competition, even though two-thirds of the states that offer an incentive program are offering more than we have to offer. And much of that is because of all of the innate qualities Oregon has that we can recruit work. As a rebate program, dollars from this program must first be spent in Oregon before incentive money is used. So these funds are only given for employment and local goods and services. Right now, demand to shoot and create projects in Oregon is at an all-time high. It is merely the size of our program at $10 million a year, the size of the fund, that is limiting the growth of our industry. Specifically speaking to House Bill 2898, our industry is not attached to the tax credit mechanism of funding, but we do need the six-year sunset to create stability for producers. As we get close to our sunset, which is now set in 2018, television producers get worried that our program might not last through their multi-year series. 2898 moves our sunset to create the stability we need. It is not, however, intended to dodge a review of our program, which we would welcome at any time the legislature wants to review the program. OPIF is a driver of industry growth, a driver of job creation, and ultimately a driver of tourism. I think you'll be hard-pressed to find a better use of your economic development dollars. Thank you so much for your time today. Happy to take your questions.
Thank you very much. We are in the middle of that review right now. That's what these hearings are about.
Of course.
And of course, the questions that several of us have already asked for a clarification on are in aid of that review from the standpoint of the Revenue Committee, which of course is trying to be the green eyeshade people when it comes to dealing with this stuff. We're not very good at it because we like films, but we try. We work hard at it, and we'll get that part done. Please, questions for this panel. Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your testimony. I'm down to David Roth and Steve Robinson, please. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on these two bills? Steve, I guess you're up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Robinson from Decision Metrics. I'm thoroughly conflicted on this measure. My daughter, I'm a numbers guy, but my daughter was a drama major, and she's now employed working on Grimm and the librarians, and so I fully appreciate the benefits of this tax credit program. What I have to say is it's more of a procedural question a methodology question. I would have like to see some more rigorous analysis on the part of the proponents of this tax credit, like any tax credit. And I'm sure, Representative Benz, you can appreciate that desire. Part of the concern I have is that the revenue impact statement on this program does not include any of the benefits of the tax credit on the Oregon economy or on the revenues to be achieved by the state of Oregon based on the increased earnings of the people who will be benefiting from the credit. I think that's a problem, and this is a problem with both for both ways and means and for revenue, I think. And I would
may I say that I absolutely completely agree with that. I asked that question of Chris toward the beginning of the hearing today. We're going to see if we can't figure out how to do a better job with that, so that we actually know what the real costs are.
Right,
and I think that's your point.
Yeah, that's the point. Is that we need to include both the benefits as well as the costs, and to do a more rigorous job, both on from the proponent side and from the state side in terms of looking at those costs and benefits. So, I have an idea though. In view of all that we know, Representative Bence, you referred to some studies that have been made of the payback to the state for this kind of program, and there have been some studies, and they do indicate that there is a payback. This is more rigorous, perhaps, than a lot of the other economic development tax credits that we have on the books as well as being proposed. And so my idea is to fund this expansion and take the money that it will take to fund this expansion out of other economic development programs that are already on the books. That way we can keep it in the economic development sphere without any increased cost to the state, but this program has some defined benefits that we can that I think we can count on. So I think that would be the proper procedure for this program. I would hate to see, you know, more money being taken out of schools, because we all understand that that's, you know, not the way we want to go. So I think that's a very viable way of paying for this program. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Roth, please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, and members of the committee. I'm David Roth, a member of Tax Fairness Oregon, and I'm glad to be back for another opportunity to talk with you about the issues of business incentives and the budget. These two bills double the annual tax credits allotted to this industry from $10 million to $20 million and double the allowable payment per project from $1 to $2 million. They also extend their current sunset dates from 20.
Of course, we do have your written material. If you could summarize the key points that you'd like the committee to hear about, that would be extremely useful for us.
I appreciate that, Chairman Barnhart. But the other side has had 45 minutes to an hour.
Please don't argue with me about that. I'm short on time today, and I'm very interested in hearing what you have to say. But let's stick to the points.
I will accede to your wishes.
Thank you.
I want to point out that the tax credit limit has gone up from $1.7 million in 2011 to $5.6 million in 2012, and now it's at $10 million, and what's proposed here suddenly is doubling that from $10 to $20 million. That's a good chunk of change. It's that kind of acceleration in expenditures that effort at establishing sunsetting as a policy for the design of tax credits and other business incentives was established in the first place. It also was the basis for establishing the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. At this point, I want to express concern that this industry also has taken the opportunity to argue that it is in the best interests of the state and of their industry if the sunset protocol is suspended, delayed, put off for a sizable length of time. Why? Because it otherwise jeopardizes improvements in the business climate for this industry. I suggest that whenever there's an incentive out there, the industry will return for the opportunity to use it to its advantage. So the Tax Fairness Oregon recommends that we put off the any increase in the incentive program, and that we stick to the scheduled sunset review as was intended by the legislature when it established this very important precedent. Let me add a couple of more points here. The industry proponents complain that the current tax expenditure is insufficient because the credits are being used up so quickly. course, they are only concerned about their own interests, so they have just one proposition for solving the problem, the supposed problem, and that is to double the available funds. We suggest that another view might be appropriate, and that is to consider the possibility that the funds are going out so fast because the incentive is too rich. That instead of, as it is, we're giving out up to $1 million per project, which could be subscribed fully with only 10 projects. We suggest that an alternative be considered very seriously as part of any discussion of amendments to this bill, alternatives to this bill, and that would be that the maximum expenditure per project be cut in half, not doubled, but cut in half to $500,000. It's quite possible, it's at least as credible as the other projections that have been offered here and are usually offered by proponents of incentives. It's just as likely that decreasing to from $1 million to a still substantial $500,000 incentive per project could very well increase the number of projects and the total gain of the state while requiring no additional expenditure from the state. Let me add that just about everything that has been said about the wonders of economic and social and cultural synergy that come with a growing film media industry could be said about a growing university and college industry. I'm suggesting here, on behalf of Taxpayers Oregon, that we could and should commit funds of this sort that are additional additions to our public education, especially to higher education, which after all here is an important source of the technological knowledge that is used by this industry, and where the folks stay put instead of threatening to leave if there isn't a big enough incentive.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearings on House Bill 2072 and House Bill 2898 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2652. Well, I'm not going to do the other name. City of Canby, please come up too.
All right, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2652, it would change the definition of rural area to mean area located entirely outside the urban growth boundary of a city with a population of 40,000 or more, and as the boundary is acknowledged in the state on which the application is submitted for a strategic investment program, it grandfathers existing definition for current strategic investment zones and parcels of land on which eligible projects are currently located. It would take effect the 91st day following adjournment signing die. And just really quickly, I'd draw your attention to, there's a document at OLIS titled Urban-Rural Distinction that lists some of the populations, and it notes that there are two cities by moving from 30 to 40,000 that would be included as rural areas at this point because they have populations below 40 but more than 30,000. And then there's also further down some distinction between an urban versus a rural SIT program. But in the interest of time, I'll just draw attention to it.
Thank you very much. Representative, thank you for being here this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Chris Gorsak from District 49, East Multnomah County. I am here to speak with you today, along with my colleagues here, about House Bill 2652. 2652 is an update to the strategic investment program so that areas that have become urban since the authorization of the program all the way back in 2002 are classified as such. This bill has nothing to do with gain share, and it also will not affect existing recipients or their benefits under the current SIP program. So currently, there are areas that are inside a UGB. that are getting the rural SIP. Washington County, as an example, receives 76.5% of the benefits of the program, second only to Sherman County's 10%. And then there are five other counties that receive less than 2% of the benefit. That's according to Business Oregon. So essentially about 77% of a rural program is provided to projects in metropolitan West Portland. Unfortunately, the SIP tool now functions in a market distorting way that pits rural Oregon against the more attractive, only from an infrastructure standpoint, more attractive areas that are already drawing significant capital investment. Further distortion in the market comes from some urban areas having a different SIP than other urban areas. That means all urban areas don't enjoy the rural incentive, or those that don't enjoy it have a loss of competitiveness for no really good reason. I think remedying the problem is not only good government, but it also serves legislators well. If someone from the media should rightly decide to look at a program like this that provides a real benefit to urban areas, they could become quite critical of us. So I believe we should take the initiative and adjust this problem in this session. And I'm here for any questions, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And I hope it's okay with you if we hear from the two cities.
Oh, yes.
Please, go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Eric Chambers. I represent the city of Gresham. We are in favor of House Bill 2652. It's a relatively minor in scope, but it has a big impact in equity and fairness across the state. As Representative Gorsuch mentioned, there's a quirky problem in the status quo related to the way that the statute declares the definition of urban and rural. Instead of just saying on the date of the application, as we would in this bill, statute says that it is on a historic date, December 1st of 2002, and whether or not it was within the urban growth boundary of a city greater than 30,000 people on that date. What that means is that the current definition of urban and rural has really nothing to do with whether or not a community is actually a rural community or an urban community, with urban communities benefiting in some cases from the incentive meant, I think rightly, for rural areas, and rural communities as a result not having the opportunity to use the incentive that was intended for them from our perspective. The legislation that Representative Gorsuch and others have sponsored is incredibly simple. It deletes the reference to December 1st, 2002, and replaces that with language that would make it on the date of the application. As Representative Gorsuch mentioned, of course, grandfathering in the current deals that the state has made and local communities have made with existing companies. From a revenue perspective, as you saw on your document, there's very few communities that are impacted by increasing the population from 30,000 people to 40,000 people for the definition of what truly constitutes a rural area. Conversely, if the unnecessary and probably overly generous rural incentive in an urban area is not applied, then there will be more property taxes going to local government and presumably to school districts, which might have a positive revenue impact in terms of the state not having to send quite as much income tax revenue to schools. So we think, again, a fairly modest scope in terms of revenue impact and what the bill actually does, but a big change in terms of ironing out equity within an urban region and also restoring the true incentive of the rural incentive of $25 million. That concludes my testimony. Happy to answer
very
any
much.
Questions you might have.
Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Renata Mengelberg. I'm the Economic Development Director for City of Canby. I'm here today to encourage you to support this bill because it preserves some of the competitiveness of our small community, which sits on the outskirts of the Portland metropolitan area. We find it very difficult to compete at times because there's perception that we're very far away, even though we're 25 miles away from downtown Portland. Having this incentive is really important to our community. It is designed to attract exactly the kind of development we would love to see in Canby. In Canby, we've worked very hard to get our industrial land ready to go. It's zoned and certified and decision ready. All of the parcels are. We have an urban renewal district. We also have our own local incentive. But having this tool in our toolkit really sets us apart from other communities around the state and hopefully positions us well to benefit from this program. And so we really encourage this clarifying distinction between urban and rural so that we can continue to compete on a level playing field. With that, I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? And I'll note that these are all the people who've signed up for this bill today. I don't see any. Thank you very much for your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2652. Colleagues, we've completed our agenda for today, and we'll see you tomorrow. With that, the committee is adjourned. So that